My name is Paul Lang, and I'm an alcoholic from Texas. I'm all right. And I happen to live in New York now, but please don't hold that against me. It's just where I ended up, okay? I want to welcome you all this evening to what I think is a special night, what may be a little bit different format than we're used to in our meetings. So I guess I'll welcome you to the non-AAAA meeting. Our speaker tonight is a professor of history, a writer, a mentor to researchers and writers, and we thought that it would be a real good opportunity to introduce this gentleman to you and let him help us provide some guidance to us on how we can, in one way, be of service to those who are trying to use our archives for research, and another way, you know, help us along. Now, this is a real difficult concept for me to deal with. I don't know if it has to do with being a male or being an alcoholic or being what it is, but I hate taking directions. And I hate people who try to give me directions. So I'm going to sit back here and try to be quiet while Ernie gives us some directions. But he's a wonderful fella, and it should be a real big thing to us. I want it so that we can kind of build the anticipation. I'm going to go ahead and let you know tonight that we have a special performance tomorrow morning. Mel from Toledo has written a wonderful song, a tribute to our co-founders, and he has very graciously agreed to share that with us. So we'll have a musical tribute tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and I know you won't want to miss that. I've been told to tell you that the elevator is supposed to be fixed by 1 o'clock tomorrow, which is checkout time. Checkout is usually noontime. But they've made a special concession to us, and they intend to have the elevator fixed by then. What was not supposed to get out, and I'm going to let you in on a secret, but don't tell anybody, this elevator thing was a sobriety test. Okay. And you're doing pretty good so far, but you don't want to know what's coming next. So we have a very special guest with us this evening in the audience. Sue Windows from Akron, and I need to acknowledge her. And hi, Sue. How you doing, dear? I heard some guy the other night. I didn't get a look at him, but I'm mad at him. I heard some guy the other night from out of town said he had come to see Sue, and I'm here to tell you that she's my girl. So I also want to thank Akron, the town of Akron, for making this possible in a lot of ways. I mean, of course, the hosts from Akron have worked real hard to put this weekend on. The group members from Akron have worked real hard to keep this city sober for us. But this is like a meeting that's been in the making for years. You know, it started a long time ago right here. I, for one, am very grateful to the AA members of this town. And And some very special people that I'm supposed to know, but my memory's so bad I can't remember their names. But they'll be the ones that are mad at me for not having said their names. You'll be able to recognize them. We're going to start tonight talking about next year's event. The people from Akron, a small, very dedicated group of people from Akron, have made this possible for us for the past 2 years. And it's a lot of hard work. Most of you people know that. You've been involved in service. You've been involved in putting on conferences and stuff. And it's time for us now to assume some of the responsibility for ensuring that this happens next year and happens in a good manner, at least as well as it did this year. I don't know what we're going to do to top the elevator thing, but you come up with something. So David has agreed to be the name taker. He just, didn't you volunteer?
Yeah.
If you're interested in beginning now to help for next week's next year's conference, next week, we can do it in a week, right? Let David know. You know, it's a lot of fun. Things like this are great. If you've not been involved in something like this as yet, take this opportunity to do it, because it's a wonderful way to serve your fellow alcoholics, fellow archivists. don't know why I make notes. I can't write what I write down. After the meeting, Dr. Bob's house is going to be open, a reception over there, which is a real treat. So for some of us who have not had that opportunity as yet, you do want to be able to visit Dr. Bob's house this evening and enjoy the fellowship over there. For those of you who have cars, we're now making arrangements for transportation. Okay. If you're driving over to the house, please take somebody with you. We need to, as I said the other night, let's don't go with an empty car. You know, there's not been a formal arrangement for transportation made, but we feel that we can take care of one another and all get over there. So if you do have a seat in your car, make sure you get preferably another drunk in it. If you have to pick up somebody just from the hotel, like they got a wedding going on, you find somebody. But take, you know, try to get one of the conference attendees to go with you. And that ought to be fun. You never know who you might find, you know. We're just about ready to start. I'd like to do a small introduction of Professor Kurtz, Ernie, if I may. He burst onto the scene, as it were, was rocketed into a fourth state of dementia. No, dementia, of course. Dr. Kurtz was working on a doctoral thesis, which was finished in 1978. And it was a fine doctorly work. And I really don't know how. Hopefully he'll help us with that. In 1979, it was published as Not God, a very, very fine history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from that point, he has been involved in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, either studying it himself, writing about it, or acting as mentor to others who are writing about it. And he's a tremendous resource to the researchers and to the authors and to just general AA members. He's a great guy and a lot of help. He has published 12 scholarly journals. He's widely published, having to do with alcoholism or the movement of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of which, one of the most notable, appeared in the Encyclopedia of Spirituality. The recent work which has been released is his, don't you just hate it when that happens? I had three brain cells when I started out, and one of them just left. The Spirituality of Imperfection, a wonderful work. And he's presently in retirement, which can be a dangerous thing. Most of the people that I know that go into retirement end up working an awful lot more. But while he's in retirement, as well as acting as advisor to those who are still working, he's attending library science school. So he's taking care of his leisure time. At any rate, that's enough about a fellow that I admire and respect his work greatly. And I bring you Dr. Ernest Kurtz.
Gail just commented that Paul would be a tough act to follow. Some years ago, I had the good fortune on three successive occasions in Atlanta, Georgia, and Moscow, and someplace in Connecticut, to be on immediately after Father Joe Martin. Now, you think Paul's a tough act to follow? Eventually, the topic announced for tonight is varieties of the Alcoholics Anonymous experience, and eventually I'm going to get to that, but in this setting, I want to start first by pointing out and paying homage to the reality that archives and archivists also come in varieties. They have different importances to different people. And one way in which I categorize this in my own mind, archives serve the functions of both shrines and factories. And I don't mean either of those words in a put-down sense. I, as a student of both American religious history and American labor history, I think very highly of both shrines and factories. People feel they need to feel connected with their past, which is part of the reality of something greater than ourselves. And that's what a shrine does. A shrine offers a sense of connection with a larger past. They less invite worship than they awaken awareness of connection, and all connection, after all, does have to do with spirituality. Archives honor the past, but they also inform the present and the future. For one theme that I am going to harp on tonight is an understanding borrowed from both Dickens and Goethe that there is a connection between memory and hope, and those who have no memory have no hope. Those who have no memory have no hope. This is why totalitarian regimes have always tried to destroy the past of any culture that they have taken over. Archives inform the present and the future, however, not only with artifacts, but also with ideas. Archives are places where memories are not so much stored as they are preserved in a state of readiness for future reuse, for incorporation into new reality, the ever-changing reality of any living phenomenon. Memory itself is less a warehouse than a construction site. Memory itself, we don't store things in it as much as there are traces there that are used in rebuilding. And therefore, the places and people that serve memory are builders as well as preservers. All living realities change. Bill Wilson, most of the other early AAs recognized that AA would change. But there are different kinds of change. On the one hand, there is the development that results from natural growth and constructive adaptation to new circumstances and surroundings. And if something doesn't grow that way, it dies because the world changes. On the other hand, there is a subversion that turns one reality into a very different reality, often the very opposite of its original thrust. Alcoholics Anonymous, like any other living entity, finds itself under pressure to change in both directions. There are pressures for the change that is life-preserving. There are pressures for the change that subverts and is destructive. Constructive change is aided by a sense of connection with history. History is not so much an anchor that keeps something in one place, than it is a stabilizer that makes it possible for the rudder to be effective. Picture the hull of a sailboat, if you would. And history is not an anchor, it's a stabilizer that makes it possible for the rudder to be effective, that prevents a boat's being toppled over by every passing wind or windbag. History is important because story is important. And few existing entities better demonstrate and more deeply realize the importance of story than the storytelling program and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Story has to do with spirituality. All the great spiritual teachers have been storytellers. When they came to Jesus of Nazareth and they asked him, "Who is my neighbor?" he did not give them a lesson on neighborhood demographics and propinquity and consanguinity. Instead, he told them a story, which reminds me of a story. You may have heard an earlier version of this story. It was told by another great religious teacher. But I would like to give you the real... Are there any social workers in the audience tonight? Good, at least one. My wife is a social worker, and I get this from one of her colleagues, and so I must preface it with that. A certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell in among thieves and robbers who set upon the man, beating him, robbing him, and leaving him lying, naked and bleeding on the wayside. And as the man was lying there, along came two psychiatrists. And drawing near, they realized the man did not have comprehensive medical coverage. They just walked right on by. And shortly after, along came two alcoholism counselors. And as they drew near, they sort of sniffed the air, and they realized that booze wasn't involved in this. So it wasn't any of their concerns. So they walked right on by. And such was this poor fellow's fortune that next along came two social workers. And seeing the man lying over there, they rushed over to him, and one of them, bending over the man, carefully examined his wounds, assessed the situation, and finally, turning to his companion, he said, "My God, this is terrible. This is awful. Whoever did this really needs our help." There are other kinds of stories. There are one thing that AA has certainly given me is the ability to listen more creatively. And I find that AA stories do not always have to do with alcohol. If I can tell you another one that when I first heard, I said to myself, that's an AA story. Maybe that's the way in which you'll learn something about me and these ideas. There was once a young girl, a little girl, carefree, buoyant, who lived at the edge of the forest, who loved to run and play in the forest, and one day she became lost in the forest. And as it grew dark and she tried to find her way home and she could not, she began to panic and she started running hither and yon, and yet every place she went, there was no path, there was no sign of the edge of the forest. And she became more and more worried. Meanwhile, her parents were worried. They were used to their daughter coming home before the sun set, and yet now the sun was about to set, and still she was not there. And going to the edge of the forest and into the forest, they called their daughter's name, but nothing happened. And so they went out to the town, the village, and they called in their neighbors and their friends, "Help us search for our daughter. She's lost in the forest. Please come and help us." And they all came, and they went in the forest. And meanwhile, the little girl, running back and forth, really only in circles, became very tired, and coming to a large clearing in which there was a rock, she felt she would sit down by the rock and rest for a moment, and as soon as she sat down, she fell asleep. She was so exhausted from her efforts. Meanwhile, the parents and the neighbors scoured paths back and forth, nothing. Most of them became tired and left, saying they would return with daybreak, but it made more sense to seek for the little girl. But the little girl's father would not leave. He had to find his daughter. And he searched throughout the night. And finally, just as dawn was breaking, he entered the clearing where his little girl had lain down. And across the clearing, he saw her leaning against the rock. And running toward her, shouting, he made a great deal of noise, running across the dry branches on the ground and shouting her name. He wakened the little girl, who opened her eyes and, seeing her father, jumped up and cried out, "Daddy, I found you." Most of you have been found. History is important less because, in Sadiana's phrase, those who do not remember the past are doomed to repeat it, than because I think in those thematic words I want to emphasize, those who have no memory have no hope. There is a link between memory and hope. Both are fragile, and so each sustains the other. Each needs the other. And each needs all the help it can get from the other. That is why the real story of Alcoholics Anonymous is important. We need hope, and our hope is founded in memory. And because memory is fallible and easily deceived, we need the archives that house and make available the necessary checks to correct memory. Let's look at recent memory and how some among you have served it. I assume you are familiar with the recently published or in-process works on Alcoholics Anonymous by Bob Fitzgerald, Mary Darrow, Mel Barger, Wally Payton, Sue Windows, who is here. The revision of Nell Wing's, an expansion of Nell Wing's reminiscences, grateful to have been there, Mel's forthcoming book. We've also been blessed with some excellent dissertation studies on aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of these studies have in one way or another been aided by archivists, by archives, by collections. I'd like, for a moment, let me just mention two dissertations which could not have attained the quality they have attained. They're not published yet, but eventually parts of them will be. Kathy Fenn of Northwestern University a few years ago on studying how AA stories are told within the larger convention gatherings. And Kathy's field is performance studies, and she studied the patterns of stories and the kinds of stories that people seem to like in those large gatherings as opposed to in the more intimate meetings. And it's a very provocative view of how story works within a fellowship. More recently, at the University of Rochester, an anthropology candidate, Maria Suara, has just completed a dissertation on how what happens within AA meetings fits understandings of anthropology of how people change. Rochester, New York, like Little Rock, was one of those places that had membership rules, and Rochester was also one of those places where AA was known as the Wilson Club. In fact, there's still a meeting there because they are very stubborn in Rochester. It meets over one of the restaurants every Wednesday at noon that calls itself the Wilson Group. General Service doesn't like it, but you know. Anyway, Maria, in working that rich area, has come up with ideas on how to listen and hear what changes. And these studies are important, and these studies would not have been possible without the cooperation of people. However, there are also dangers of distortion in Alcoholics Anonymous' story. If that's the good news, now I come to the other side. Less happily, there have also recently appeared people who, in pursuit of particular agendas, tell AA's story in ways that distort its history. A bit later, I will mention three specific such distortions, but here I want to frame some points in the context of a very real concern over the Oxford Group enthusiasts who try to provide historical underpinning for what has become a movement to Christianize Alcoholics Anonymous by reinterpreting AA's early history. There's nothing wrong with reinterpretation so long as it is based on evidence. One reason we tell stories is to upgrade memory, and we revise our stories and our memory as more information comes in. That's how memory works. But there are three guidelines that should undergird the process of any historical study. And archivists, when the young historians come to you and are working with you, make sure that they are doing these three things. This is what I learned this not only in history seminars at Harvard, but from some of the archivists that I was interviewing on a project that I was involved in when I was in graduate school in history. First, there has to be evidence for any claim. What is your evidence? Just because you think it would be nice if something happened in a certain way does not mean that it did. Some people think Bill Wilson must have known Dr. Bob before Bill ever went to Akron back there in April of 1935. Maybe he did. I do not know for certain. But all the evidence that we have says that he did not. And therefore, if someone says that he did, please show me your evidence. This may not seem like such a big deal, except that it would call into question Bill's fundamental honesty in a very important area. It's not merely trivial, like whether Dr. Bob had his last drink on June 10th or June 17th. Thanks to the research of an attorney in New Jersey, Merton M., it seems almost certain that Dr. Bob's last drink was actually on June 17th. I do not expect you to change the date of Founders Day. However, this is the kind of error that is so absolutely typical. They did not on June 10th, 1935, write down in a notebook, Dr. Bob had his last drink today. Because he'd had that lots of times. And I'm fairly sure, 1938, they're working on the book, Bill picks up the phone, calls Bob, says, hey, what was the date that you had your last drink that time? And Bob said, well, let's see, the convention is always the second week in June, and let's see, what were the Sundays in there? And, June 10th sounds good, let me put down June. That's the way in which these things happen. I can give you dozens of examples. I doubt that discovery impacts anyone's sobriety very much one way or the other. And as I said, I don't expect you to change Founders Day, and I don't expect you to change its literature, even if Merton's evidence, which is so far is not totally convincing, but there's a preponderance of evidence. He's going on the registration of the hotel and the convention dates and what were the pre-convention events, and it looks pretty good. But what is your evidence? The other one that I use very often is, again, just because a book is on someone's shelf does not mean that they have read it. Is there anyone here who has a book at home they've not read yet? Yes. You want to see my pile? And therefore, those who go and look at libraries and say, these books were on the shelf, and therefore Bill must have read them, and these books were not. No, not necessarily. You need other evidence that books were read. So what is your evidence? And obviously someone's looking for evidence if they come to you. But I still think any archivist I ever worked with always interviewed me. not formally, but you know, they came in to tell how serious, and they would tell me these little stories of what kind of researcher Arthur Schlesinger was, you know, sort of holding up the, don't do that, that totally kills the spirit of young historians, but keep us honest, we need you. The second requirement is you have to look at all the available evidence. Yes, certain things did happen in Akron, but other things were also happening in New York and elsewhere. One problem for a long time is that these two places wrote history from just on the basis of what they knew happened there, on the basis of documents or memory. Other things were also happening in New York. The historical storyteller has to take into account everything we know, not just the facts that he or she happens to like. Actively drinking alcoholics are pretty good at that, by the way. Just looking at the truths that you like. You can make a marvelous story out of things like, well, I always got up and got to work in the morning. I never missed a day's work. Never mentioning the fact that you had to be poured into bed every night and how often you went home at 10 o'clock in the morning because you were too sick to do any work. And so it's not, you can't just use some of the evidence. You have to use all the evidence available, always realizing that more evidence may come in. I'm going to mention a few places where I would change things in Not God if I had the opportunity. More evidence has come in, so much more evidence. One of the greatest results of that book is that it got people to go out and dig things up. Historians love to be proved wrong because that means you've read us and are taking us seriously. Really. I mean, you know, there's nothing more. Richard Hofstadter is one of the great American historians because two generations of young historians tried to prove him wrong. And eventually they totally shot down his thesis. But, you know, this, I mean, he had written such a provocative interpretation that he got people to go out and find out things that no one had known before. And that's what I hope you will do. And when a history comes out, don't just say this is good history or bad history. Find out what's wrong with it and get up the evidence and add that evidence to the pile. It's marvelous. Truth and honesty require examining and incorporating all the available evidence. If you have all the available evidence, you'll always find it in some way or other it's going to be contradictory, and then you've got to start working on interpretation. And that, again, if you do it honestly, that's all there is to do. Thirdly, you also have to look at what else is going on at the time, the context. What is the wider climate of opinion? Yes, the book Alcoholics Anonymous shows signs of being influenced by Oxford group literature. True. However, also being read at the time were Karen Horney's 1937 book, The Neurotic Personality in Our Time, very obvious glimmers of which can be found in the Big Book. In Dale Carnegie's 1935 bestseller, How to Win Friends and Influence People, you will find a chapter subheading titled, When You Are Wrong, Promptly Admit It. Some early A members had been in therapy with Horney or one of her followers, we know that for certain, and Bill Wilson, for one, really was an avid fan of Dale Carnegie. And therefore, in discussing influences on early AA thinking, these names merit mention along with those of William James and Henry Dunant and Emmett Fox and the Oxford group writers. The Big Book was stolen from more sources than you can count. And you know, they didn't have Richard Peabody's Common Sense of Drinking, coincidentally in Chapter 5, has this marvelous sentence, halfway measures are of no avail. In the Big Book that belonged to Jimmy B. in the AA archives, there's a big star in the margin next to that, which basically meant, steal this. And there's nothing wrong with that. The AA Big Book doesn't pretend to be a work of original scholarship. It brought together, it looked at all the literature on alcoholism, and it tested it against the experience of the alkies, and they threw out what didn't fit, and they kept what did fit. That was a great contribution. It's not original scholarship, though. Every idea in the Big Book you can find somewhere else. It's just pulled together in a unique way and validated for the first time in history by the alcoholics themselves. That's its significance. We need look also not only at the context of the time we are studying, but also the context of our own time. In the vocabulary of his age, for example, Bill Wilson was a flirt. Since then, he has been a womanizer, a male chauvinist, and a hegemonic white male oppressor of women. And depending on the context of the time, each of those is accurate. Each age has a different vocabulary to describe certain phenomena. Sometimes those vocabulary, those words and terms are laden with the values of the time. Again, one thing that history gives you is a sense of the fact that these things are time-bound. And to recognize that we all see through tinted glasses. No one is bias-free. The obligation is to be as aware we can of our own biases. And I was really helped become aware of mine by not only my classmates in history, who I expected it, but also by our class. And, you know, because you are so deeply immersed in the materials. You're sorting them, you're looking at them, you're watching out for something happens that you have a sensitivity to this. AA's story will always be rewritten and always be in need of rewriting. Someone suggests that I revise, not God, and I respectfully decline. I would make some changes, I'll indicate. But my story is a story of AA's intellectual history, its place in the history of understandings of spirituality in the context of the mid-20th century in the United States. That was and is my expertise. I think I've told that story as well as I can tell it, and I think it still has a great deal of validity. What we need now is a history of Alcoholics Anonymous written by someone who is skilled in the economics and politics of nonprofit organizations. We do not know anything near the full story of the impact of the Rockefeller Empire on the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't really know that much about Willard Richardson and Frank Amos and Leonard Strong and the other perhaps indirect influences in diverse ways in how they may have impacted. Nor do we know the significance of the work and the contribution of people such as Horace Crystal and Hank Parkhurst to the early foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am convinced that if Hank did not drink again, we would be celebrating three co-founders. Hank surely would have been listed as a co-founder, convinced based on what we know of his story. That's why I'm waiting on Merton's work, and I wish he'd give up being a lawyer so he could spend more time on his research. Except if he did that, he wouldn't be able to make a living. But again, the next history, based on the interest of this age and some of the materials that have become available, the story of AA, the organizational side of AA, and how nonprofit organizations, how they form, how the Alcoholic Foundation was formed and turned into general service. This is an exciting history, an exciting story, if it finds the right talent. And, you know, someday out there, I hope someone picks this up. Roughly 25 years it takes for each new rewriting, and Not God was originally published in 1978, so it's getting time for the next person to do the research. By the way, there's something that I've been looking for the whole that one of you may have. You know the story of Dr. Bob's last drink? Dr. Bob got up that morning, looked at Bill, and said, I'm going to go through with it, and Bill thought he meant the operation, and Bob said, no, you know, I mean this thing we've been talking about. And so Bill and Ann put Bob in the car, and they gave him a bottle of beer to steady his hand as he went to the hospital. God, think of the potentials for malpractices, huh? And Bob went in the hospital and performed his surgical specialty. Bob was a proctologist. It strikes me that that's probably the most famous asshole in history. Does anyone have a picture of it? I mean, somebody should find out who Dr. Bob's patient was on June 17th, probably. You know, and just, you know, and it should appear in every AA clubhouse in the world. We all have fantasy lives. And then there are the small points. These are the ones that I haven't solved yet. Some of the Oxford Group enthusiasts and others from Akron say that Dr. Bob had vastly cut down his drinking even before Bill Wilson's arrival. The participation in the group had helped Bob to go only on an occasional binge. And that's what most people who I interviewed or whose work I've looked at sort of say. That Bob really cut back in the Oxford Group but couldn't stay stopped. Yet in 1946, Bob gave a lead in Youngstown, Ohio, and his talk was covered by a reporter who in the paper the next day said, quote, the speaker told how he ended 35 years of steady drinking after trying various methods that included hospital and sanitariums. Ardent reading of the Bible and an earnest desire to stay sober also failed. He still got drunk every night. Then he met the other founder-to-be who had been sober for 4 months and had learned that the way to convince himself was to convince some other drunk, end quote. Okay, Bob may have been exaggerating in order for an impression that night. This was by a reporter who may not have heard Bob accurately. I mean, this having this doesn't mean that all that other testimony is wrong. However, it does. Reporters are very good at taking down exact words, especially when they put them in quotation marks. And if Dr. Bob said he got drunk every, this I go to work on that. Love that. Love it. Love it. Even in other areas, I would add additions. Not God does not give adequate recognition to Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. In 1937, 2 years before the publication of the big book, Silkworth published in the Journal of the New York Medical Society an article on reclamation of the alcoholic, dealing with the distinction between two terms, decision and resolution. You know how the third step reads? Resolve to turn our lives over to the care of God. It doesn't read that, does it? And yet that was the word always used with alcoholics. Listen to this. You may never hear the third step exactly the same again. Silky said, without quibbling over words, I wish to differentiate between a decision and a resolution, of which the alcoholic has probably made many already. A resolution is an expression of a momentary emotional desire to reform. Its influence lasts only until he has the impulse to take a drink. A decision, on the other hand, is the expression of a mental conviction. Often, when a resolution is made, individuals must fight constantly with themselves. The old environment forces are still arrayed against him, and he finally succumbs to his old means of escape. However, if he has made a decision through the understanding of facts, he has changed his entire attitude. No willpower is needed because now he is not tempted. And surely Silkworth talked with Bill about this, which was such an important part of his moral psychology. Silky was always there. He was available. The theme of AA history and AA spirituality, and now I get to the title, Varieties of the Alcoholics Anonymous Experience. AA spirituality is open to difference. You cannot close it up in a box. Nothing spiritual can be bounded because only the material has boundaries. This is why there are no rules in spirituality or in AA. Openness to difference. Because we are finite, there is no once and for all. In the words of chapter 5, which led to the title of my book, first of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. If I were to write another book on AA, its title would be Varieties of the Alcoholics Anonymous Experience. The vast diversity of meetings and groups is surely the outstanding characteristic of AA today, but this is not some new postmodern thing. In a 1946 pamphlet put out by Cleveland AA, we read, AA groups are not mentioned in the 12 steps, nor are hospitals, central offices, minstrel shows, clam bakes, bowling teams, softball leagues, open meetings, or many of the other activities of the movement. AA groups are fundamentally little bands of people who are friends and who can help each other stay sober. Each group, therefore, reflects the needs of its own members. The way a group is managed is the way its members want it to be managed for their common benefit. As a result, we have large groups, small groups, groups which have refreshments, groups which never have refreshments, groups which like long meetings, groups which like short meetings, social groups, working groups, men's groups, women's groups, groups that play cards, groups that specialize in young people, and so to many. Notice they don't mention groups that don't smoke. Continuing the quotation, each group has its own customs, its own financial problems, and its own method of operation. As long as it follows as a group the same principles AA recommends for individuals, unselfishness, honesty, decency, and tolerance, it is above criticism. Because this is a large country, and because the cultures of various sections and cities differ, because of chance and faith, there is not great uniformity in AA customs. The only national standards are the book Alcoholics Anonymous and the literature put out by the Alcoholic Foundation. The foundation tries to curb dangerous practices and to avoid undesirable and inaccurate publicity. Remember, this came out from Cleveland. 1946, though. See, tolerance does not mean putting up with. Tolerance is the active embrace of difference. This is what it's so hard to understand in general. Bill understood this, and he was reflecting really Alcoholics Anonymous. In talking about these membership rules, we heard about them last night. Bill commented in a grapevine, the way our worthy alcoholics sometimes try to judge the less worthy is, as we look back on it, rather comical. Imagine, if you can, one alcoholic judging another. Bill said that in 1945. In a letter that Bill wrote in 1964, he said, in the early days of AA, I spent a lot of time trying to get people to agree with me, to practice AA principles as I did, and so forth. For as long as I did this, AA grew very slowly. And when Bill gave that first talk at that small college in New Haven that has four letters in its name, at the summer school, Bill, there's in the typescript, this isn't in the actual published article, but it's in the typescript, which is published in some places. After Bill finished his beautiful talk on the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, some young squirt of a physician with a stethoscope in his pocket in the back seat raised his hand and said, Mr. W., could you explain in one brief sentence how Alcoholics Anonymous worked? And I met one person one some year who was there. He said, Bill's knuckles got white on the lectern. I mean, that's what he'd been doing brilliantly. But he looked at the fellow, fixed him with a smile, and said, honesty gets us sober, but tolerance keeps us sober. According to Ann Craw, who I interviewed from Akron, that was Dr. Bob's second favorite saying. His first one, of course, was keep it simple. But honesty gets us sober, tolerance keeps us sober. And if you look at the article of Bob that they choose to reproduce most often in the grapevine, it's Dr. Bob. Maybe because of the rigidity of his own personality. Have you ever met a surgeon who didn't have a rigid personality? Bob recognized more than others the need for this, and therefore he made it so central. Wider expressions of this became poignant at times. To someone who wrote to Bill complaining about the actions of some AA members, someone had made a pass at her at a meeting. This only happened once in 1963 in Manhattan, never before or since. Bill replied, AA is not a communion of saints, it is a company of sinners who, under God's grace, have been endowed with the power to perform miracles, but not always. Alcoholics Anonymous is a terribly imperfect society because it is made up of very imperfect people. We are all dedicated to a perfect ideal of which, because we are very human and very sick, we often fall short. I know because I constantly fall short myself. In a letter to Ollie J. in 19... Ollie went off... Every new enthusiasm, especially in a line of spirituality, Ollie went after. Ollie had gurus before anybody else had gurus. Ollie was using crystals and channeling before anybody else ever heard of... Ollie was a real jerk. It's marvelous in AA. Some are sicker than others. Right. But Ollie was a good friend of Bill. Bill used to write if Ollie would go off on one of his enthusiasms, and he rarely drank over them, and Bill would write these letters trying to calm Ollie down. And Ollie went off on one of these things that was somewhat similar to the Oxford group. And Bill wrote, do not think I neglect guidance or prayer. I am a firm believer in both. I pray for reduction of the ego and to do God's will. But I am fully aware and humble enough, I hope, to see that there is nothing infallible about my guidance. Nobody can cause more grief than a power-driven guy who thinks he has got it straight from God. These people cause more trouble than the harlots and the drunkards. I ought to know, I've had spells of this myself. I think that's marvelous. When's the last time? How many of you even know what a harlot is? Shame on you. Cause us more trouble than the harlots and the drunkards. I see threats from especially three directions to the integrity of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to say something about them because one of the reasons I'm here is to get you to think and talk. The three directions are the Christianizers, the New Agers, and the minions of the treatment industry. Each is driven by its own agenda, an ideology so profoundly embraced that its proponents seem convinced that they are committed to real AA. These are three different visions of what is real AA. And it's only fair, after I shoot these three down, I hope successfully, you may not agree, but then I will tell you what my idea is of real AA. Because often, again, when I'm dealing with professionals, which is what I try to bridge between professionals and AA, and you know, there's so many varieties in AA groups, and you can read so many contradictory things even by members of the fellowship. The professionals say, "Okay, now what? You know, what is real AA? You know, I went to this meeting, and they were talking about their inner child, and you know, when did this come into AA?" And they expect me to do that, but I don't do that in research. I tell them what is real AA, so I'll do that when I finish. But first, these three threats. Daring to come in here and tell you people what is real AA really takes chutzpah anyway, doesn't it? You know what chutzpah is? Chutzpah is a child who cold-bloodedly murders both of his parents, then throws himself on the mercy of the court because he's an orphan. That's chutzpah. It ain't nothing compared to what I'm going to do. The Christianizers, in their single-mindedness, seem blind to the other sources of AA ideas and practices. Yes, Dr. Bob and Bill, especially under the influence of Ann Smith, read the Bible, especially the New Testament, and especially the Epistle of St. James. But that's not all that they read. And they were not the only influences within AA. The Christianizers' hearts are pure. I'm willing to give them that. But this distortion of AA history is especially perilous at a time when AA is being categorized as a religion by some United States. I mean, I have, and I've never had to go and testify at a trial because they realized that it wouldn't work. But I've given depositions by phone. You know, it depends on what you mean by a religion. It depends on what you mean by all these things. And court is no place to settle this. I don't take these court decisions seriously, by the way. I don't think anybody else does. But at a time when this is going on, let's be careful how we use words and reflect history. The problem is, he doesn't care what anybody calls it, the problem is this can make it more difficult for some alcoholics who need the fellowship to find the program and its help. Who was a speaker yesterday or today said, you know, if it hadn't been for the words as we understand him after God, I wouldn't have been here. There are others like that. And to take that away... I'm not interested in AA as organization. AA is alcoholics. And AA especially is its potential members, those people out there who are still drinking. And this kind of activity makes it more difficult for some of them to get the program. The earliest AAs were dedicated to keeping the door of AA open as wide as possible. AA's own story has been one of the progressive widening of that already open door. Anything that works against that seems untrue to the story, especially when people try to justify it by AA history. And the way in which AA has made room explicitly in advance of other places in our society for women's groups, for non-smoking groups, for gay and lesbian groups, for groups in prisons of various kinds. This, who would dare to narrow that doorway? And to Christianize AA, which is untrue to its history. Yes, there was Akron, but there was also Jimmy Burwell and others in New York. And that's why we have asked, we understand him after God, and that's why the phrase on our knees was knocked out of the sixth step, seventh step. The second problem comes from, it seems the opposite direction, but I think the same, the New Agers. I've often wondered what corrupts AA more, being near a treatment center or being near a university. I have had the good fortune to not spend my life near many treatment centers, but I have had the bad fortune to spend most of my life near universities. I usually have to drive 25 or 30 miles to find a good AA meeting. I'm not kidding. I'm serious. And it's not the academic alcoholics. It's the people from the university who come in and try to study it, and then they think that they're alcoholics, and you know, oh, God. Though enthusiastic about what they term spirituality, the New Agers' faddish shallowness turns many away from seriously investigating AA. Alcoholics Anonymous was earlier confused with encounter therapies. One contribution of Charles Diederich was that in founding Synonym, he demonstrated that AA didn't do that because he had to found Synonym to do it. Now, this New Age philosophy, it seems to me AA is rooted in the acceptance of limitation. I am an alcoholic means that I cannot drink alcohol safely in a way that this culture calls normal. It is an acceptance of limitation. New Age philosophy, whatever its proximate trappings, is essentially pantheistic or technically panentheistic. It eventually, inevitably denies limitation. Read Common Boundary, read the best of the New Age literature, and you will find in it, if you are at all familiar with the history of philosophy, an implicit panentheism. Essentially, it's going to eventually deny limitation. It poses more danger to contented sobriety than all the urgings to moderate drinking for problem drinkers who are not alcoholics. The AA Big Book, by the way, talks about. I am, for one, enthusiastic about moderation management because it does not attack or trash AA. It explicitly says it's for problem drinkers, not for alcoholics. In the language of DSM-4, it is for alcohol abusers, not for the alcohol dependent, which is that distinction. It's the distinction on page 31 of the Big Book between certain type of hard drinker and real alcoholics, alcoholics like us. It's not new. It's in the Big Book. This denies that distinction, lumps everybody together as this treatment. AA derives from an ancient tradition of wisdom founded in the same acceptance of finitude and limitation, a tradition dignified by many saints and scholars. To try to make it seem otherwise, for whatever supposed reason of marketing to moderns, is untrue to its story, and because it is dishonest, is unlikely to succeed in furthering a program that stresses honesty. Archives like history exist in service to truth. Now, the New Age vocabulary, again, if you will follow it through, you will find in it this implicit denial of limitation. I taught in Denmark for a week last year, and there's an anthropologist who's doing marvelous research on AA, Vibeke Steffen at Copenhagen. And fortunately, most Danes speak English, because my Danish is really atrocious. But I talked to her, and she said the reason in Denmark why people insist they will not go to an abstinence program, said in America you believe in equality of opportunity, but in Denmark we believe in equality of results. And for a person to not be able to drink would mean that they are less human than other people. And therefore the only way to achieve equality is to have everybody in the same place. Therefore we can't let anybody drink, or everybody has to be able to drink. And I'm real interested in following what happens in Denmark with its alcohol policies, because this is explicitly being developed. Now, I don't know to what extent some people at least have this idea in this country also. I think she was too kind to the United States. There are some people who feel that though somehow if you cannot drink alcohol, you are flawed. Well, if you can't drink alcohol, yes, you are flawed. Human being. All human beings are flawed. It's the spirituality of imperfection is about. The great thing is to know what your flaw is. That's where you alkies are so lucky. You know what's wrong with you. Other people just wonder. And this, again, the New Age philosophy will not accept that. The third threat, I think, comes from the pushers of treatment who've long tried to wrap themselves in the mantle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Modern treatment for alcoholism did not grow out of a medical setting. It rather grew out of AA farms and serenity houses. The word treatment, in fact, God helper, was probably originated by Sister Ignatian, who heard people coming to the hospital and referring to taking the cure. And Ignatian was not an expert on alcoholism, but she learned from Dr. Bob there was no cure, and so she's the first one who applied the name treatment, and I hope God forgives the woman for doing that. I'm sure that he does. But I mean, just, that's where the word treatment comes from. And treatment was fine. The treatment that grew out of AA farms and serenity houses helped many people. But then came money and professionalization, a demand for credentials that required even those with good sobriety to talk the vocabulary of psychology. For a time, I was director of research and education at Guest House, which is a treatment center for Catholic priests. I say for a time because I didn't fit in that environment very well, and so I didn't last in that job too long. It's one of the things I'm rather proud of, actually. But our counselors were AA, and they were salt of the earth. They had marvelous sobriety, and in general, you know, they had high school educations and were really had skills that they'd practiced until they became alcoholic. And they were marvelous because, you know, the priests were all smarter than they were and came in and tried to outsmart them, and they sat there and let the priest outsmart them and said, "But Father, you're still a drunk." And they weren't a threat to the priest, so they learned. And these guys were marvelous. I mean, they had a sobriety that was actually contagious. Then they got this stupid credentialing requirement in Michigan that every year they had to take some exam. And in order to pass the exam, they had to be able to answer all these questions. And these questions had to be answered in the language of psychology. One of my responsibilities was to help them learn this language so they could pass the exam, because that's the only way we could be a certified program. The trouble was that after they learned that language, they started talking that language also to the clients. And they bring in that language back into the A groups. I had to try to, as much time as I spent preparing for the exam, after they took the exam, I had to unlearn that language again and try to get them back, you know, the credentialing and the language of professionalization. Bill White of Bloomington, Illinois is currently working on a history of treatment. It should be published sometime next year. It's going to be a blockbuster of a book. Wait for it, watch for it. It's going to be very good. Some of you have, Bill has interviewed you, you've helped him. He's an amateur historian, but he knows how to work with archivists and draw on this. And the best defense against those less interested in helping alcoholics and enriching themselves is the true story of their origins and the relationship they have to AA. In diverse way, your archives contain the raw materials of that real story. You may think that things having to do with treatment are not part of your archives. I tend to disagree. Because treatment tries to wrap itself in the mantle of AA, and we need to be able to go and find out how that happened. And therefore, the relationship of your groups to treatment centers, at least in my, everything up here is obviously a suggestion, no one speaks for anything around. But it seems to me that the history, not of treatment, but the history of the relationship of your group and groups in your area to treatment are an important part of finally settling this problem. These treatment people who wrap themselves in the mantle of AA until you get something where they're identified with AA, like that stupid U.S. News and World Report story a couple of weeks ago. It wasn't that bad. The cover was one of the stupidest things I've ever seen. What AA won't tell you. It had nothing to do with a story on the inside by Nancy Shute. Which brings me to, okay, Ernie, what do you think is real AA? I'll tell you, I'll give you five hints. Forget that you are AA archivists. You are now a bunch of academic professionals who know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. And you've gone to some Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and some meetings, you know, you've heard this, and other meetings you've heard that, and you're real confused. And so, you know, you punch into some search mechanism, who's an expert on AA, and strangely my name pops up, and so you get a hold of me, and you invite me down, or you call me on the phone. And this is what I'm going to tell you, and I need people like you to check me on this, so wear both hats if you can right here. I say there are five ways, I think. Every place listed in a meeting book is not necessarily a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what's happened to this broadening concept of 12-step programs in substance abuse. And if you want to know what real AA is, first of all, it's a place where they use the language and vocabulary of the 12 steps. There are precisely 200 words in the 12 steps. Count them sometime if you're bored. Have nothing better to do. And therefore, it's a place where people talk about defects and shortcomings and making amends and taking an inventory and prayer and meditation and carrying the message. Not a place where people talk about complexes and repressions and inner child and codependence. In a real AA meeting, they use the language and the vocabulary of the 12 steps, not the language and vocabulary. There's nothing wrong with the language and vocabulary of psychology. It's a great, you go to your psychologist, you, by God, he better talk the language of psychology or you're getting cheated out of your money. But in a Alcoholics Anonymous, the language should be the language of the 12 steps. Defects of character, shortcomings, making a decision, turning over, seeking through prayer and meditation. Secondly, there's always going to be a lot of laughter in AA meeting. There's going to be a tremendous prevalence of humor. It is going to confuse you. You're going to wonder what they are laughing at. The things they're talking about will embarrass you or make you sick to your stomach, and they are going to be laughing. See, you got to realize that sober and alcoholic is a funny expression. Putting those two words together is like a contradiction. Humor is the juxtaposition of incongruities. Laughter is this characteristic. You know, we cannot see our own incongruity. We're put together funny. And when people tell stories, they hold up a mirror. People are never laughing at the speaker. In the speaker's story, they see a reflection of themselves as something they've never seen before. And the reason it's so healing is they're laughing at themselves. And let me tell you something. I did my research first in the Boston area, and a lot of these meetings were held in the basement of large Catholic schools. And, you know, when I did my early research, I didn't realize that in order to understand AA, you got to get there a half an hour early and stay at least a half an hour late. I would get there promptly at 8:30, sometimes 8:35, and I'd leave as soon as the clock struck 10. I learned nothing until I learned you got to come early, you got to stay late. You got to go out to Shoney's or Hojo's or wherever the group. I mean, this is also the meeting. But in those early days, when I'd come early, I'd arrive, and, you know, sometimes they'd have an AA meeting in one room and an Al-Anon meeting in another room in the same night, same place for convenience. And I sort of had to figure out which room was the AA meeting in, because I was studying AA, not Al-Anon. And I quickly learned. I stood out in the hall until I heard a burst of laughter. That was the AA room. Now, let me say this, because it's a lot funnier to be an alcoholic than to be married to one. So I'm not dumping on Al-Anons. I mean, I understand why there's not that much laughter in Al-Anon. However, in the Al-Anon meetings that do practice the 12 steps, as opposed to those that have been taken over by the Children of Alcoholics movement, there also is a great deal of laughter, it seems to me, because, again, it's the mirror is held up to our own. So there's a sense of humor. If you are at a meeting for 10 minutes and you don't get either laughter or tears, you're in the wrong place. Because, see, humor and comedy are intertwined as the masks over the stage remind us. Both recognize we are put together by this strange mixture of body and spirit, of infinity and finitude. Thirdly, the story style. Do the stories told share experience, strength, and hope by describing in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now? Or, as someone told me, an academic I was interviewing, and I said, at your meetings, do you do this? He said, well, we do some of that, but mostly we tell what's happening to us and how we feel about that. Now, that's marvelous. A lot of therapy groups work that way. However, that's not what it says in the How It Works chapter of the Big Book. How it works is our stories describe it. Notice it says our stories describe in a general way. And we heard last night why. It also, among other reasons, it also does not say our stories describe as if we were appearing on Geraldo. Our stories describe in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. There is the implotment. There's your $15 word for tonight. You know, the way in which the movement is structured. And any a setting in which the real A meeting, that's the framework of the story. It won't always be in perfect balance, but they always will get all three elements. Our stories describe in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. It need not be about someone's drinking history. At discussion meetings, they may go around a table. Someone may ask, how are we going to get through the holidays? It's my first Christmas sober. They'll go around the table. When I first came in, you know, this is how I approached the holidays. Then this happened. This is how I approach the holidays now. It's not only around the drinking that's the pivot point. It's about other points of spiritual access in one's life. Fourthly, and this one maybe should be first, it's awareness and faithfulness to AA's 12 traditions. AA's 12 traditions are to the spirituality of groups what the 12 steps are to the recovery of the individual member. AA's 12 traditions are to the spirituality of the groups what AA's 12 steps are to the recovery of the members. Do I need to say that again? I will anyway. AA's 12 traditions are to the spirituality of the groups what the 12 steps are to the recovery of its individual members. Professionals need to respect this, especially that as AAs, we have no opinion on outside issues. Don't ask an AA whether alcoholism is a disease unless the AA has a PhD after his name in physiology. professionals, and this is the one where professionals sort of chip away. I think the groups do a better job on the traditions than the people who come and study. This is the place where I got to preach to the other people I talk to. Professionals keep getting in the way. A lot of researchers set up these marvelous projects that they, you know, they can't carry out. By the way, this is one responsibility you have as archivists. Some very researchers may come, and you may very much want to help them, and for diverse reasons, but you are guided by the ethics of the fellowship, and especially by the 12 traditions, and it's up to you to guide those researchers. Now, it's not just to tell them no. It's for you to help them find ways to operate within the traditions. They cannot use the meeting list as a list of names to send their questionnaires to, but you can tell them how they can ask questions of members because you know. And you know, they come wanting to treat AA like they treat any other group. So they're not bad people or stupid people. You, as well, some of them are. But I think that as researchers, as archivists, our responsibility is to help professionals use their expertise within the ethics, and they're used to this ethics of what they study. And finally, there has to be the sense in the group that people are there not because they want to be there, but because they need to be there. This is a toughie. This was brought home to me. An AA speaker I will never forget said, "I didn't come around here to save my soul. I came in here to save my ass. I've been around for 2 years before I learned they were connected." There's got to be people who are there because they realize this saves their lives. Now, the trouble is, when people go to a program that they need to go to, things happen to them to make other people want to go there too. And I don't have a solution for this except to recognize that you've got to have in every group at least a core of people who know that they're there because they need to be there. They know their ass is connected to the soul. Mel, could you write a song on that? You know, that old hip bone song. Let's extend that a little bit. So those are the five things that it seems to me, and if, you know, if you've got comment or feedback, I love it. But this is how to separate AA from CODA and codependence groups and substance abuse groups and chocoholic groups and shopaholic groups and I hate my father-in-law twice removed groups. And these characteristics, I think, will be there. The vocabulary, the humor, the story style, respect for traditions, and sense of needing to be there in any genuine group. They're not all going to be hanging out that obviously all the time. Finally, in conclusion, when I was doing my research, one of the most poignant experiences I had was the people that I was interviewing when I finished would say, "Well, Ernie, what do you think? How long will AA last? Will AA still be AA in 50 years, in 20 years? Interestingly, this was 20 years ago. And I assure those people that, first of all, a historian is not a prophet. We look to the past, not the future. But I know what they were asking. They say, you know, you are getting a look into the fellowship from this different direction. We want to know what you think about this. It's very precious to us, and we know that we are going on. What is it going to be in the future? And I promised them that in my, the published work, I would put in an answer to that question. And I did at the end of the first edition of Not God. And then after 10 more years of research and thought, when I did the revised, expanded edition of Not God, I added that chapter from Bill's death up to the 1985 convention. I added to that, and I'd like to conclude by reading those two passages linked to you because they still sum up the best that I can what I think I learned in my research, and also the answer to that very important question. Back in 1978, I wrote, "So long as somewhere, when a sober alcoholic meets another alcoholic, drinking or sober, and sees in that person first and foremost, not that he is black or white or male or female or Baptist or Catholic or Jew or gay or straight or whatever, but sees rather an other alcoholic to whom he or she must reach out for the sake of his or her own sobriety. So long, in other words, as one alcoholic recognizes another alcoholic, first and foremost that she or she is alcoholic and that therefore both of them need each other. there will be not only an Alcoholics Anonymous, there will be the Alcoholics Anonymous that you and I love so much and respect so deeply. And some 10 years after that, in what was at the time the book AA the Story, since incorporated into Not God, I added, for the deeper answer is that alcoholics, once they have tasted sobriety, try to hang on to it, and therefore to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the way of life encapsulated in the 12 steps, protected by the 12 traditions, and extended through the 12 concepts. It is conceivable, I suppose, because all institutions degenerate, that individuals who call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous might someday ignore service, violate tradition, and scorn the steps, or worse, pay them only lip service. But should that happen, I am certain that somewhere, perhaps under a battered bridge or in a dingy alcove, some alcoholic who is trying to stay sober will sober up to some other alcoholic who may even still be drinking and say, "Stay, buddy. You must be awfully thirsty. Let me tell you how it was with me when I used to need a drink." And at that moment, an AA meeting will begin, and the story of Alcoholics Anonymous will continue, and nothing I or you might do can destroy that. For that I am, as I am sure you are, profoundly grateful. It is very unlikely that those two alcoholics will have an archive. But especially after this weekend, I am very convinced that the spirit that connects them at that moment is the same spirit that drives you in what you do every day. And so I add my thanks to theirs. Thank you very much. Moderate to some extent. Moderate.
I'm going to take just one moment. You can't respond to this, or I can't respond to this, I don't think. But I'd like to express something that I thought while Dr. Kurtz was speaking to us. I would submit to us that in the beginning there were people, non-alcoholics, who loved us and were instrumental in the development of what has become our fellowship. And there are still people like that, many people like that. One of the main factors in achieving sobriety is the ability to embrace, to whatever extent we can, the truth. Do we dare to not listen to a truth teller, no matter where they come from? We're going to have 15 minutes for comments, questions to Dr. Kurtz, and thank you very much, Ernie, for your message.
Yeah, and let's make it Ernie, okay? Dr. Kurtz makes me want to reach for my stethoscope. Somebody in the back is putting drops in his eye. That's not a raised hand. That's okay.
I can say Ernie?
Please do.
Thank you, Ernie. I really am glad that I was here. Would you explain to us again exactly what you mean by the second idea you had that was dangerous for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous? And using the New Age, I didn't really quite understand what their influence does
okay.
to
us. What's called New Age religion or New Age philosophy comes in many forms. Sometimes it is an attempt to embrace an Eastern religious tradition, except very few Buddhists in Asia would recognize American Buddhism. And I'm going to have some stories on that, which we need not go into. What is implicit in all of this New Age material? If you read, I like the work of Charles and Anna Simpkinson, for example. They're very sympathetic. I like what they do in Common Boundary. Some of their stuff is very good and usable. But underlying it is a view of the world and reality that essentially denies limitation. If there's anything wrong with you, change the way you think and you can make it better. And you will find this in New Thought and in Christian Science among the American origin religions, and some aspects of Christian Science have moved away from this, I realize now, but you will find this in this characteristic American philosophy. You find it in other places also. And what it is technically, I didn't allow myself to just say pantheism, but you know, the idea that everything is God. It's a kind of panentheism, which there's someone here who knows more about than I do, so I'll call on him if you want more about it. It is, though, the equivalent, really, of denying a distinction between the individual human being and a divinity. And therefore, any limitation that we have is something that we can overcome, if only we think right, if only we're strong enough. To me, it's very dangerous for alcoholics to start thinking that way. Because it's very easy to convince yourself that you now have control, you know, of your drinking. Yeah, I would recommend to you, if you would like a different viewpoint, Gregory Bateson has an article in Psychiatry in 1971 entitled The Cybernetics of Self. I don't expect you to go to the library and find Psychiatry for 1971. It's reprinted in the paperback book Steps to an Ecology of Mind. The article, The Cybernetics of Self, is really an analysis of AA from an anthropologist's point of view. And he says AA wins by this judo-like maneuver that only by surrendering. You know, and as long as you try to fight the thing, you're going to lose. And I think that this is an expression of what really happens when people start thinking in this other new way. They get caught back up into this thing. And the danger is, if this overtakes Alcoholics Anonymous is going to become just another form of positive thinking. And if positive thinking worked, we wouldn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. Positive thinking entered the American mainstream in the 1870s. It was very strong in the 1910s. It was available again in the 1920s and 30s. It was around the edges of AA from the very beginning. Ethelred Folsom, who gave High Watch Farm in Connecticut to AA, or tried to, AA smartly moved away from that. These were people, followers of Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy and various other of these new thought modes of thinking. And it sounds wonderful. They sound very spiritual. They sound very loving. They sound very charitable. They sound very tolerant. They are all of those things. They are marvelous people. However, at some profound level, they cannot accept that they are essentially limited. And they are going to have the same problems that our friends in Denmark have. Now, if equality means that you have to be able to drink like everybody else, and otherwise, then eventually they're going to try to. So I've already found people, seen people, and heard people talk in AA who relapse, slip, whatever term you use. I like retrovert that they used to use in the early days. Retroverts among you. So does that help clarify it somewhat?
The Herbert Spencer quote, have you ever found any evidence of where that,
No, and I went to the library and spent two afternoons searching through the dusty tomes of Herbert Spencer. And there's a woman in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who, as far as I know, is still doing it, going through every work of Herbert Spencer. And therefore, if anyone ever does, please call or write me, because to some people this is very important. But that's one problem with the big book not having footnotes. But it says, the end of appendix? It's one of the end of the appendices, right? Yeah. Okay. It says that, you know, this comes from Herbert Spencer, and no one has ever found it in the works of Herbert Spencer. However, Herbert Spencer's works came in different editions. You know, to really do a full search on this, you probably have to take 2 years out and do nothing else, and no one's going to pay you for that. In fact, if anybody out there wants to pay me for that, I'd be happy to be the one to do it. This is like, you know, the phrase deflation and depth does not appear in varieties of religious experience. They know how difficult it is to get a phrase when you're reading a book. You know what I did? I hired a 10-year-old kid to write on a separate sheet of paper for me every word in that book that began with a D. I didn't tell the kid what I was looking for. And I still have in my files, I think, 25 pages of narrow line paper in his childish handwriting. Every word in varieties that begins with a D. I can say without fear of being contradicted that the phrase deflation in depth does not appear in William James. The idea is there, obviously. But it's very difficult to prove a negative, and it's very difficult to find a particular phrase. However, you ask a question that I'm glad you raised. Let me toss it out to you. Some alchemists are known to be obsessive-compulsive types. And if any of you ever get bored with life and feel that your life has no meaning, let me set you off on this task. Go to Herbert Spencer's works and find the quotation that's in there. And please call me when you find it. Faye, have you found it? Where? Give us a reference. You know, I was looking for it and you didn't tell me. I'm having problems with this. Yes, I did. When I was down in Little Rock.
You asked us that question? I'm sorry, Ernie. I don't remember that.
Okay, tell everybody.
Well, I can't take credit for this. I'm not quite that obsessed with Spencer's quote. But a member of our archives committee and a past archivist in Arkansas was. And he communicated with the General Service Office. He sent letters to everyone he knew, and even one of the senators in Arkansas who had been doing research in one area or another of Spencer. But I'm trying, and see, this is why I almost hesitated and why I was so long in raising my hand. I believe it's the principles of biology, and it's definitely in there. I've seen it. It's a two-volume set on biology that Spencer wrote.
What page,
Faye? I'm sorry.
Oh, come on.
Here's why. Well, I don't walk around with an archives in my head. Mm-hmm. Right? I can't tell you. I can't. If you ask me what page you're quoting the big books on, I don't do that either. I don't memorize books, but I will do this. I will send you where that is.
You have my address and my email address, and if you either give her or me your card, we'll pass it on to you. I will verify it before I pass it on. It's not that I don't trust Faye.
I understand, and I wish you would.
It's just, you know, my opinion of Arkansas has declined in the last 6 years, roughly.
And now we know what ego deflation at depth is. Thank you, Ernie.
Thank you. I'd love to see it, as I say. It's, you know, very much wanted to get somebody to whom this is a big deal. And I am obsessive compulsive. All historians. Charlie.
Ernie, we know the Washingtonians were founded in 1840 and then disappeared in a decade or two less, you know. And anybody who read that book, it almost sends shivers up your spine. It's like it's AA, you know. We know probably that Bill Wilson read that and it was of help on the traditions and all that. But in a larger question, and you're an expert in the field of the history of ideas, do you have any thoughts on why AA came into being in 1935 and not 1910 or 1822 or...
AA could have only come into existence in the American 1930s in the form in which it is. This was a culture... 1914, the outbreak of World War I, was for Europeans, as anyone familiar with the thought of Karl Barth knows, sort of the watershed where they lost faith in modern progress. And America, because of its triumphant role in World War I, because of the economy of the 1920s, once the inflation of 1921 was surpassed, was sort of convinced, this is the age of total optimism. When the crash hit in 1929 and the Depression unfolded in the early 1930s, you get the sense in the step one essay in the book 12 and 12, Bill talking about what it means to be bankrupt, especially for the middle class people who made up the earliest AAs. They were people who were convinced that they were the masters of their fates, the captains of their souls. And they, when they reached the point, they recognized that they were powerless over their economic well-being. You know, for many of them, they try, what mistakes had they made? And I think it is very difficult for us to recapture this now. And if we ever forget it, that's when we're going to have another. The reason the past can't repeat itself, by the way, is you can only have one first time. As long as you remember, it can't happen exactly the same again, because people remember that they're going to do something different. But when people forget, then it can happen again. We've got a generation now who may have forgotten 1929. We do. I mean, I still teach, and young people do not understand, and I'm not even sure how many of you do, the depth of the 1930s and the frustration. I began my dissertation research on the city of Cleveland. I backed into AA as a topic. That's one of the ways I backed in. And I interviewed people who talked about, you know, they were they were middle class people and they had decent clothes still, although they were a little bit threadbare, and at night they would dress up in old clothes and go to the garbage cans behind the Holiday Inn Hotel to rummage, because the Holiday Inn still tried to maintain the facade, the denial, I suppose you'd want, of the fact that, you know, the economy was okay, and so they still were preparing food and then throwing it out. And they told me of looking up across the garbage can at another bum and realizing that the other bum was somebody who they had worked with, an executive in the bank that they worked with, who was also there scavenging for garbage in the garbage cans behind the hotel. Now, when you get people who had managerial-level jobs reduced to that condition, people who were selling apples because they were too proud to beg, everyone knew, no one bought apples. Well, no one even believed that they were selling apples except Hoover. And the reason that they were selling, they were too proud to beg. And so they had to give you something, but they really give us something. And this, the culture hit. 1929 was to the United States what 1914 was to Europe. It was a look into the abyss. And this made it possible, this whole context made it possible for the alcoholics to understand what happened to them in those terms that just happened to plug in to the ancient pietist vision that there is an infinite distance between the human and the divine, and there's nothing we can do about it. We are in need of somehow being saved by a power outside of ourselves. And AA might have come into existence earlier or later, it would have been something different. The American 1930s were also the age of the CIO. Earlier unions had been craft unions. CIO was an industrial union. People had a sense of belonging together as brothers. And no longer was the brotherhood simply a socialist ideal. The 1930s, however, was the high point of the popularity of the American Communist Party, because anything that said we need each other was attractive to a lot of people. And so whether it was the new labor union movement, the CIO, and the coal mines and the auto industry which come out of this era, this sense of up until this time, Americans were unbridled individualists. Needing someone else was a sign of weakness. And for the first time, really, this wasn't the way in which this nation started. But from the economy of the 19th century, managed to seem somehow to convince people that, you know, you didn't really need anybody. People thought that, we heard about the Oxford Group coming to Aquin in 1931. One of the reasons why some people were a little bit unsympathetic to the Oxford Group, Bud Firestone was quoted in the Aquin newspaper as saying at an Oxford Group meeting, the man with Christ in his heart can outsmart all the others. This was not the spirituality that was attractive to people who were at bottom. This is the kind of spirituality you still may find in maybe Crystal Cathedral spirituality. It's, you know, they got these different strains. So this sense of being able to admit I need someone else, especially these two Vermont individualists, Bill and Bob. I was so struck. They both came from Vermont. Their backgrounds were very individualistic. In a bar, they probably wouldn't have even talked to each other. They were so different. And the first big variety of AA experiences of Bill and Dr. Bob, vastly different human beings, instinctively respected each other and maintained that respect throughout. And when Hank came to Cleveland to dump on Bill and try to enlist Bob, Bob wouldn't even listen to him. And, you know, this whole... Bill and Bob are two of the most unlike surgeons. There's no one more independent in the world than a surgeon playing God at the operating table. You know, even a proctologist has played God in a different part of the body. And, you know, these two men, and a Wall Street person, you know, the ones who manipulate the financial world, that Hallmark Hall of Fame thing, I think, captured that very well. And the way in which these two men from finding each other and recognizing this in a way that they conveyed it, not by words, but by their actions. This came out of a context. I don't think it could have happened in the 20s, and I don't think it could have happened in the 40s. The culture had hit bottom, which made it easier for individuals to admit the same. Sorry, I've gone on a bit. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Comment or two, if I may, and then a question. Shoemaker, stick to thy last. It's better to do one thing supremely well than many badly. The very life of this fellowship depends upon the preservation of this principle. And I'm sure you're familiar with that. And if you please, also in the 12 and 12, where it talks about the man that came at the door in connection that on AA, in the AA calendar, it was year two. Is there kind of a misconception there that wasn't really an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, or was it? Here to comment on the importance of our singleness of purpose and primary
purpose. Give me that
purpose.
Second one again. I'm not sure I understand the second one.
Yes, sir. The strange alcoholic, the one that came at the door with the other affliction, were stigmatized.
Oh, yeah, okay. And they tried, that one that Bill had that thing about, they tried to exclude alcoholics, that incident, okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. First of all, if I can handle the second one, people still debate whether that other affliction was homosexuality or this person was an ex-convict. Most of the gay community think it must have been homosexuality. Again, my answer is, what is your evidence? Because there is evidence that being a convict was as stigmatized at that point, and that there was fear within AA of identification with convicts. So, but it was almost certainly was one or the other. And the point is, in this singleness of purpose, this is one of the things that makes AA stand out, and this is why I think the traditions are so important. Shoemaker's phrase was taken to heart. This is the acceptance of limitation, like the alcohol saying, I can't drink alcohol. This is the fellowship accepting limitation and therefore setting the example. In my understanding, it's extremely important, and I think that AA has acted extremely wisely, and I think AA is jeopardized. However, the reason for it is that what makes AA work is identification. And there are some groups in which when people identify themselves as chemically dependent, people can identify, and other groups in which they can't. So it's difficult to impose on groups anything here. There's been some interesting research. Alcoholics can identify with the users of prescription drugs and marijuana. The line is between those things and hard drugs. Alcoholics cannot identify with street drug people, neither can prescription drug abusers and marijuana users. And so it seems in some treatment centers I know they put these two groups in two separate tracks. I think the Betty Ford, by the way, is one, where if you're an alcoholic, prescription drug abuser, or a pot smoker, you're in this program, and if you shot heroin, sniffed cocaine, or you know, went on to some of these psychedelics, you're put into this track. Because these two groups don't identify across. Well, that's a treatment judgment. The thing is that AA has singleness of purpose, and the point in this, where the second one comes in, it doesn't matter what other affliction you have. You know, if you are an alcoholic, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female, black or white, Baptist, Catholic, Jew, gay, straight, whether you have AIDS, whether you're dying of heart disease, whether your nose is crooked, whether your ears have fallen off. I think women's popular magazines are pretty, and the most positive portrayal of alcoholics in the stories that appear in women's magazines really sort of peaked there in the mid-1970s, 1975. I mean, Mary Tyler Moore, Mercedes McCambridge, and Betty Ford, God, how can you not love them? And shortly after that, under the impact, I think, of the exaggerations of the child of alcoholic and codependence movements, the other things started to slide in. I think that the criticisms of such people as Wendy Kaminer have a great deal of validity. We have, in many ways, there are trends in this culture that lead to thinking in terms of victimhood and these popular movements that pick that up and turn everyone into victim. AA, because it comes from this traditional religious, spiritual understanding, the concept of victimhood, make, you know, pour me, pour me, pour me a drink. And, you know, get off the pity pot. Get off the AA group I hung around with in Georgia. There was about a 350-pound woman there who just would sit there and periodically, whenever she sensed a tiny degree of pity, would start to, get off the pity, Pat, get off the pity, and you know, just, ah. But you did. And this is one of the things, again, I would add it if I knew how to add it in a way that was not objectionable to my criteria. Real AA meetings, people do not view themselves as victims. And I think that here I will take the work of Wendy Kaminer and Carol Tavris and other such writers who I think have accurately fingered something that should be criticized, but that I don't feel they make the mistake of saying that this is true of AA. I don't think this is not true of the AA like we had last night. I said this earlier. I just said it was that whole meeting, no one mentioned their inner child. I got this bumper sticker on my car, abort the inner child. Solve two problems at once. Actually, I don't have it on my car. I couldn't get anybody in Ann Arbor to print it, so if you have better luck going on. Talk about a politically incorrect bumper sticker. One more, I think there may be time for. Deborah.
Thank you, Ernie. I'm not sure that I can actually verbalize this question, but it was what you were talking about, singleness of purpose and the importance that the basis of our program is through identification. And one of the things that I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous now, we study the big book, and the fact that the stories have been changed in each of the editions. And as I understand it, it is in order that more of the general population today can identify with us. And I think it has to do with the changing of the stories that they're talking about, maybe putting into the big book that will include other things. And do you see where I'm going with this? Can you comment on that?
I've thought about this, and I'll think out loud as I've been thinking. What they are attempting to do, I believe, again, and remember what it must be like to work for GSO and have 2 million Alkies as your boss. Never forget those poor people. But they are attempting to widen the door, that thing that I talked about. A began with an attempt to open the door as wide as possible. However, there's a point where you widen the door so far you no longer have a wall. And I think this is the question that you're asking, is has the door been widened so there no longer is a door? I don't think so. And I think that the answer, the salvation here, if I may use that term, is the autonomy of the groups. Remember that thing I read from the Cleveland thing in 1946? And still, the autonomy of the groups. I am struck. I find real AA in some groups that, by God, you better mention alcohol in the first sentence, and you better mention it in every other sentence, and if you say pill or chemical, you're told to leave the meeting. And they think I'm good AA, by God. And I know other groups where people come in and identify themselves as chemically dependent. Their chemical of choice was alcohol. They talk about alcohol, but they also talk about some of the other things that they took that also seem to have to do with their alcoholism. And some of them will talk about being gay and the way in which perhaps being gay impacts them in a special way in their alcoholism or in their social life. And as long as these are the way in which someone is a woman or, no, just these different, and as long as the people there are identifying with the relationship to alcohol, these are, by my criteria, which I gave you explicitly, good meetings. These are meetings where healing takes place, where people have a spark in their eye, where they're doing 12-step work. This is one criteria for health. You know what I've got? I got a new criterion for alcoholism counselors. I cannot get it through NADAC. You got to be barfed on once a year, preferably by a live alcoholic. But, these groups, this is, and so I think we're going to have a variety of groups. What I tell professionals is not for you to tell AA that they should be tolerant. You should find a group that fits your client. And there are some groups in any area that you've got to be alcoholic. There are other groups that you want to talk about another thing, okay. But there are some groups where gay people feel more comfortable. And in all these groups, you've got people who are sober. The way in which you make a referral to Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't give a meeting list and say there's a meeting on Tuesday night at the Fifth Presbyterian Church. The way you refer to a person, the way you make a referral to Alcoholics Anonymous is you find an alcoholic who has the kind of qualities you want your client to have. You call that person and you introduce them. And I have professionals sit there looking at me cynically. I think if it gets known in the community that you're serious about helping alcoholics, the AA members will make themselves known to you. Don't let me down on that, people. If there's a social worker or a physician who you find out is genuinely trying to help alcoholics, let them know where they can reach alcoholics who are in recovery. And that might mean, you no longer get out of your bed and go down to Skid Row. You get out of your bed and you go to a psychologist's office to meet somebody that the psychologist wants you to take to a meeting. because a psychologist wants that person to have the kind of sobriety you have. That's a compliment. Even if it is a psychologist, it's still a compliment. People do recognize quality sobriety. And so I think, rather than worrying in the abstract about this, although I understand the worry you express, I revel in the fact that there are so many different good AA meetings. And I prefer to focus on that side, just because it helps me sleep better at night. I think that's it. We're all going to Dr. Bob's. Isn't that a marvelous state? Thank you.
Ernie, I wish everybody in my home group had been here tonight to hear you. I think you understand this better than some of the people I go to meetings with. Thank you very much. We're going to wrap up real shortly here. You may have noticed that we started to pass the basket and then did not. And the reason we did not is that we ourselves are not exactly clear on what kind of a meeting we had tonight. And if we're not an AA meeting, we shouldn't pass the basket. All right? However, this group of people did incur a large expense to do this. If you're so inclined, as you leave the room tonight, you can certainly make a donation if you feel comfortable with that. I myself will. So thank you for bearing with us on that. We're going to prepare to go to Dr. Bob's house. And as I said earlier, we're going to help one another get there, I believe. I can tell you tonight that I will leave this room much prouder to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous than I have been in some time. So I thank you all for having been here to let this meeting happen. Since we do have a very wonderful guest with us tonight, I'm going to ask Sue Windows if she would please come to the podium and lead us in our closing prayer tonight.
We make our own little circle here. Grab his hand. Come on, Chuck. Come on up here. Get Paul's hand. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.